Welcome to Ride On, episode 29. I'm James Gross, and I'm joined by my co-host, Julia Thane. Julia, what's new? I think you were in New York last week for Climate Week. What happened? How was New York in the fall, beginning of the fall?
Autumn, as we call it on the East Coast. Yes, New York was great. I was there last week for Climate Week. Let me tell you, James, there was a ton of energy there, a ton of people there, and I had a few takeaways. One is that the number of people and the level of excitement from the folks there around climate was totally incongruous with what the news has been about climate. So we heard from scientists that were looking to overshoot 1.5, maybe even overshoot 2 degrees climate change in 2030. There were some policymakers like the UK, China, US, who didn't show up to some pretty important meetings during Climate Week. That said, there were more people who marched in the Climate Week march that weekend than ever before. There seemed to be a ton of enthusiasm and optimism and just general energy and money in the Climate Week events that I attended. And so all of that was really, I would say, energizing. The second key takeaway for me is that Climate Week this year was about tech and finance. Like, policymakers didn't really show up as much or didn't show up as much in full force that they have in previous years. And so it seems like finally kind of like tech and finance are understanding their role in the climate transition really showing up en masse to do that. The third takeaway, James, is there wasn't a ton of micromobility at Climate Week. For the audience, for this podcast and for this YouTube channel, you know, there were some companies there. And James, you should talk a little bit about the companies that you and I met during Climate Week. But I think that this connection of climate and e-bikes, or climate and micromobility writ large, is really, again, not well understood. It's not well quantified, and it's not well put in front of investors. So I think that continues in my mind, like, this is my thing, that I think we continue to underestimate the power of associating climate now with micromobility solutions, especially privately owned ones, in a way that's kind of detrimental to the overall level of investment in micromobility. So, James, what do you think? Agree, disagree with any of what I just said about Climate Week and the presence of micromobility there?
Yeah, that's good takeaways. The one event I attended, you know, I walked in and the first thing I saw was like their two biggest sponsors were, you know, car companies. And I just kind of laughed. It was interesting. So I don't know. I wasn't around it enough, I think, to have real takeaways like you do. So, but overall, it sounds really good. And yeah, I don't think there was much micro as part of that conversation, which is okay. I mean, there's other things clearly that can be done to attack climate. But yeah, we gotta figure that out for micro. Today, we'll have someone on the show that's very interested from a mission-driven perspective on how his company can help with the climate impact and mobility. So, maybe they're just, going other places. I don't know. It's a good point. There wasn't a lot of exposure there from what I saw.
Yeah. The only thing I would say on that is that there's so much money in climate. I mean, there's like billions and trillions of dollars in climate, and that's on a global perspective as well. So I think if you're a micromobility company and you're not thinking about how to quantify the emissions of your product or how to partly sell it as a climate product, especially when you're talking to investors, you're not going to have access to this billions or trillions of both public and private money. And so, again, I think it's just a kind of a key takeaway for micromobility companies of all types that climate is an important thing to consider. It's not just about the tech or not just about the mobility appeal of it.
Yep. Billions and trillions. Come on, folks. That's a lot of money. Let's go get it. Well, we have some giveaways, Julia, as part of our announcements today. These are not quite billions or trillions numbers, but they are really, really cool vehicles. So first is we still have our 10 ways CGO 600 Pro giveaway going on. We've got a lot of responses, and thanks for everyone who has already engaged and responded at ridereview.com in this giveaway. We'll announce the winner next week to this awesome vehicle. And then 10 ways will also be out Micromobility America here on October 19th and 20th with a really cool booth and exhibit with a lot of their vehicles. So hopefully, if you can't make it to Micromobility America, of course, you can win one, and we'll announce that next week. And if you can make it to Micromobility America, plan to ride some 10 ways in just a couple weeks here. As well, I wanted to announce the winners of our two GoFlu giveaways. This is, not billions and trillions of dollars, but could save your life out on the road, which maybe is worth billions of trillions of dollars. So we had last been a month now, I think we interviewed Julia Betts, the founder and CEO of GoFlu, and she was so kind to offer us two giveaways. So first is the Body Glower, and the winner of the Body Glower is Jonathan Ramos. And the winner of the GoFlu body bag, as they're called, which is really cool. I'm jealous. I don't have one. Is Brookie Holt. So we'll send both of you an email, but congratulations on winning and participating in those contests. Julia, my final announcement is not a giveaway, but it's actually just an unveiling of our schedule for micromobility, which is live. Julia will be there and one of our key speakers and also moderating and emceeing the city stage. And so we've got amazing speakers that are now at micromobility.io with the Ad Agenda Live, coming from experts from the FDNY, as I interviewed Laura Kavanaugh last week, to Trek, Electric, CPSC, which is the Consumer Protection Safety Commission, as I understand it, McKinsey, Bird, Apollo, Uber, Waymo, a US DOT, Department of Transportation, Lime, and many, many more. So it's going to be kind of an awesome 2 days, a lot of content, and then, of course, a lot of riding with our first ever Ride Expo, a joy to that. And so, you know, you can still get tickets. You can get tickets to both days if you're really interested in the content. If you just want to do the rides, of course, you can just get a ticket to the Friday Ride Expo. But yeah, we'd hope to see you all there, and check out micromobility.io for the latest information on all the content. Julie, anything to add there before we dive into the news?
Just that I'm really looking forward to the conversation, and for everybody who's considering coming or who has already bought tickets, I would say one thing that this conference does really well is reflect what's happening and what's changing about the sector and about the industry. So the fact that FDNY, that CPSC are coming and are spending, you know, so much time and attention on something like this speaks to things like batteries, battery fires, what we're going to be seeing upcoming in certification and battery use. And then, you know, some of these other partners that are maybe a little bit less of an emphasis on shared micromobility and more of an emphasis on private micromobility. Like, there are going to be some really, really good conversations, not to mention just being able to check out the cool micromobility vehicles, which is always my favorite part of the conference. So definitely hope to see people there and check back on the program, because it is quickly evolving. We're adding more speakers, and October is a beautiful time to be in the Bay Area. So hope to see you all there.
Beautiful. I agree. Okay. So one other thing, Julia, I haven't told you this, but we're still trying to lay out a theme for the conference. We often try to do this. You know, we had 5 billion riders as a big thing last year. And in talking to Horace Dedieu, of course, who's a big part of our team, you know, he has been very kind of heads down excited about the Vision Pro that Apple has put out. And as well, even earlier this week from Meta, they re-released their Ray-Ban glasses and showed the integration of AI into their Ray-Ban glasses. And Horace is very excited. Again, I just tell this to the viewers, we're not sorry, completely set in stone yet, on this idea of so many of these new technologies. So you mentioned a lot, like CPSC and FDNY and the changing nature of like the concerns we have around batteries. But then we also have like Waymo coming. And of course, we know Waymo's play in self-driving cars. And then with Apple and Meta, now they're coming out with, of course, like these vision and these technologies. And Horace has this idea of, you know, increasingly the next computing platform will be about looking up, not down, right? And making the world your canvas. And so, you know, really, where before you could argue, clearly the iPhone or other technologies like it had a big impact on mobility, you know, maps and things like that. At the same time, these newer technologies, which we, you know, maybe wear on our face or we wear around us and also are combined with a lot of software, to really allow us to maybe change the way we move and in a really positive light. So I'll just tease that out, that Horace is working on that. I would expect a lot of kind of announcements from us and thoughts around that from us. And hopefully while we haven't announced it, we'll also see some of those companies I was just talking about also at our event, discussing how some of their technology can change mobility. And so, yeah, that's just one final thing I wanted to tease out that we're really excited about and hope to have some more information on soon.
Excellent. Cool. Well, James, should we get into the news?
Let's do it.
All right. This week is a good news week. which is my favorite kind of week. Love a good news week. And want to start with the first story around how Americans' travel patterns have changed. There is a think tank in DC called the Brookings Institute. They have a really good research program on cities called the Metropolitan Policy Program. And they recently put out a report just analyzing how Americans' travel patterns have changed since the pandemic. Top line, what they found is that Americans are commuting less, and they're also taking more short trips. So the kinds of quick jaunts that are really perfectly suited for micromobility modes. According to the analysis, people have generally substituted those longer commutes for shorter but more frequent trips to eat, shop, and run errands. And one of the things I found really interesting about this report, James, is that, you know, essentially when you look overall at vehicle miles traveled or passenger miles traveled, we recovered completely in 2022 compared to 2019. So now people are, you know, traveling at the same level they used to be. But the types of travel they're doing is very different city by city. So the TLDR of this analysis and what really people should take away from it is that cities are going to have to be much more context specific in how they create transportation options that really match people's new needs from the transportation network overall. So I thought that was super interesting and something that absolutely we'll have to talk about on the city stage at Micromobility America. And James, I'm just wondering, anecdotally, like you were in New York, you like live kind of closer to San Diego. Does that track with what you've been seeing on the ground?
Yeah, definitely. We'll share the graph. But you know, the graph is pretty great in that it shows the broader New York City, New Jersey, and Long Island areas with the largest kind of change in trips up almost like 100% from 2019 to 2022. That's awesome. Congratulations to them. I'd also like to point out just really quickly that while it is so much of New York City, clearly in terms of population, you know, New Jersey still, and we've covered this before, but Jersey City has been able to accomplish now Vision Zero, I think for 1 or 2 years in a row now. And the way they're such a great case study in terms of how they've not just mode shifted, but really helped people feel much more secure walking and biking than maybe anywhere else in the country at this point. And so that's just a great case study. I'd love to get someone from Jersey City at our events or maybe on the pod just to talk about that because it is this broader area, not just New York City, that's winning there. And I think they have a big part of that. Juxtapose that to, and you know, Julia, I was talking to you about this a little bit, but I was just in Connecticut, the area at Westport, and which is a really nice area. I have friends there and was working. And I was shocked. I was there, you know, probably covered 25, 30 miles over a couple of days, and I saw one e-bike. And now again, coming from California, in an area that clearly people can kind of afford e-bikes, you know, like I wouldn't think it's a price issue. That was really shocking to see, especially with such a beautiful area at a beautiful time of the year. And I think that comes a lot down to, of course, policy and the way those roads are designed. And, you know, so it's not just all of like, it's so deliberate, I think, what's happening in Jersey City, for instance, versus what's happening in Westport, Connecticut. And so those are the things that all can change, though, and hopefully they will. And yeah, just other shout outs to, you know, a lot of California cities have moved up a lot. San Diego, as you mentioned, Julia, Bakersfield, LA, San Francisco Bay Area has grown quite a bit. And then also just, you know, because I don't think we covered enough, some of the, you know, just other areas that are not, say, coastal. It's really cool to see places like Ohio, Toledo, Ohio, Chicago, broader areas, Joliet, Naperville, Baton Rouge, Cleveland, Mentor, Ohio, Cincinnati is up there on the leaderboard too, and in the broader area around there. So just, you know, yeah, great to see.
Yeah.
And hopefully it continues.
Yeah, yeah. And just for viewers, the charts that James is referencing are from Bloomberg. So Brookings analysis really talked about how travel patterns have shifted within U.S. cities. And so the tension there is that some of these short trips might actually be replaced by cars, whereas we really, you know, from all sorts of perspectives, livability included, need to substitute them with walking and cycling. This Bloomberg analysis and Bloomberg chart looked at how U.S. bike trips have changed since 2019 in some of the largest cities across the country. And there were some, as James mentioned, some huge winners. New York, San Diego, Bakersfield, Las Vegas, Richmond, even LA actually was among the winners of metropolitan areas where we've really seen up to, you know, 96% increase in growth in trips. And then some places that used to be like familiar, you know, cycling hubs like Portland or like Minneapolis actually had either a drop off or reduction in number of trips, reduction in number of trips, or they just had slower growth rates. So I think really, really interesting. The moment is now. As much as we talk about, you know, tech and finance getting into micromobility, we still always need good policymaking, and that good policymaking has to not only include the incentives and the rebates, it has to include the fundamentals like the bike lanes, everything else. So just James, to round out that story with a couple more stats. According to smartphone data, Americans overall took 37% more bike trips in 2022 than in 2019. That's great. That's amazing. The fact that we have 37% more bike trips in 2022 than 2019. And then second stat to keep in your mind is nearly half, so 48% of Americans now say they are interested in buying an electric bike in the next 5 years. And this was according to a study or a survey rather from Adweek Morning Consult. James, what do you think the role is of e-bikes in pushing up some of these bike trip numbers and in that growth in American cities between 2019 and today?
I think it's all of it. You know, I haven't seen the study, but my guess would be, my guess would be acoustic riding is down since 2019 to 2022. So I would guess it's not only displaced some acoustic riding, it's just been, it's been net positive.
Yeah.
It's where all that growth is. And then, yeah, the other thing I'd say, and you know, you mentioned it with the roping study, but it's just, it's so cool how, you know, a lot of, we talk it off a lot about mode shift, but what some of that behavior from roping shows is, of course, that like you can, mobility can be additive when it's enjoyable. And, you know, so you might actually go on more trips. You might decide to change your trip. You know, you might not daisy chain as much if you're on a e-bike versus in a car where you feel like, oh, I'm going out once, I'm going to do all these trips, you might take more. So there's just some really cool patterns there that I would imagine also create some growth and, you know, just make us more mobile. There's so many productive reasons as a society we want to be more mobile, whether it's putting eyes on the street, whether it's, you know, bringing commerce to businesses, whether it's exchanging and meeting new people. It's just so great to see these numbers because they have such great second and third order effects much beyond just like someone not driving in a car per se.
Yeah, yeah. I want to make a few more points on this before going to the next news story. I mean, this is a really important topic. One is that also implicit in, you know, having people take more short trips is this need to underscore land use and housing and like a new match of having housing closer to places where you need to go. And I think that's the subtext of the Brookings Institute analysis. And as I've always said, urbanism is the opposite of side of the coin of micromobility. Like cities and e-bikes walk hand in hand. So you really need to have that emphasis on land use policy. The second thing is, James, just anecdotally, I would agree with this. The growth is 100% attributable to e-bikes. And also now folks are swapping out acoustic bikes for e-bikes. And I'm not even sure that they're keeping their acoustic bikes. And I'm definitely seeing that in LA, where when I look at bikes now, I mean, like 9 times out of 10, it's an e-bike rather than an acoustic bike. What that says to me, this is like my final takeaway before I'll move on to the next topic, is that we just need more retrofitting solutions. Like there's going to be a lot of stranded assets out there in acoustic bikes. I think, you know, having this safe option for being able to put a battery on a bike or another company actually that we saw at Climate Week, Clip, where they like literally clip onto an acoustic bike and are able to make it an e-bike. Things like that are probably under innovated on in the market and will be a huge boon, not just to what we're seeing in the US, but also what we could see worldwide. So James, any other final comments? Yeah. Otherwise I'll move on.
No, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, okay. So just on this topic of all electric, the question here, important for all bike share operators, is the future of bike share all electric? In Detroit, the nonprofit service there that runs their bike share logo says its electric bikes are ridden 3 times more than its standard bikes. In LA, the number is something like 6 times more. In New York, I believe it's 5 times more. So again, when we talk about whether it's privately owned micromobility or shared micromobility, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Customers are choosing electric bikes versus standard bikes. James, what repercussions do you think this is going to have on the cost of bike share, and also how many operators we're going to see in the market?
I mean, good question. On the cost, you know, it should be, if there's, you know, ideally, and again, not, this is, study specifically says 3 times more demand than standard, but I'd just be curious if they're actually seeing more riders. If you're seeing more riders, ideally, that's just a wider pool you're drawing from. That's a bigger market. Ideally, that can drive the cost curves down. Like, there's no reason that, you know, we're not going to be able to make electric bikes for cheaper than acoustic bikes, especially if we have a lot more demand in a simple market model. So ideally, it doesn't increase the price. Now, clearly, the prices are higher now, but I think in time that could change. I think it has to change. I still think, you know, for instance, Lyft in New York is just too expensive. I know, like, there's a lot that goes into that, but that's, ideally those prices continue to come down. And then finally, you know, yeah, I think we've just hit the point. If you're proposing a bike share and it's acoustic, like, you should really think about your policies, because I just don't think that's what people want. And maybe you want it, but that's not what people want. So
right,
do what people
right.
want.
Yeah. Is it a sunk cost? Is it a sunk investment? Like, should you even be investing in things like that today? And I think it's a really excellent point. And just to plug a panel or a fireside chat, actually, that I'm doing at Mobility America, I'm going to be speaking with one of the leadership team at Lime. And so we'll pose to him the same sort of question, like, for any of your vehicles, are you really thinking about doing anything except for electric? And in the cities where you're operating too, like, how are you seeing the performance of your e-bikes or e-scooters versus other types of acoustic modes? So James, just wrapping up the news here with maybe one other plug at a reel that you did, and is on MicroMobility's Instagram page and on YouTube channel, and also just kind of a cute story. These days, only 1 in 10 American children bike or walk to school, which if you have kids, you know, creates this car line chaos and, like, a host of other social problems around schools. But fortunately, folks like James and others are leading these bike buses that are happening with kids around the country and really around the world, who are all sort of getting together on their bikes. And it's, like, the most adorable little thing, seeing all the little kids bike to school with their parents. So James, I feel like I can't really report on the story because I don't have kids. I just kind of live across from a school. But what do you think? Like, what, besides bike buses, what's another alternative to, and what would you like to see in this space?
Well, maybe it's you living across the street from school is part of the host of social problems that 1 in only 10 kids riding or walking to school creates, which is, like, again, if you've seen the chaos that happens because of these drop off and pickup lines, it causes problems for everyone. You know, people around the school, it creates a lot of course, car congestion. It creates a lot of pollution because cars are just idling a lot right there in residential neighborhoods, which, you know, just residential neighborhoods aren't previously used to. And so it's just one of those things that we'll share the article from The Atlantic, of course, where they wrote a long piece about this. But the idea is, you know, it's 1 in 10 today. About 50 years ago, half of kids rode or walked to school, and then the other half mostly were driven by bus. So, you know, it's just ideally a better mode share than every kid being dropped off in an individual car as well. So it's just an interesting social phenomenon where the market doesn't like this, right? Like, no one likes this necessarily, right? This is inefficient, it's expensive, it's wasteful, it's all these things, right? And so you just have to think, oh, this will actually be solved at some point. The bike bus is a really clever hack to that, right? And again, the bike bus I've been involved in are super small. People have done much bigger ones. I'd say it doesn't matter how big they are, you should do it no matter what. But, like, what are the other hacks and what are the other ways we're going to get around this? Because it doesn't really, we tend not to get less efficient over time. But, like, this is a very good example that every parent goes through, and it's incredibly wasteful. So, you know, how do we get around this? And so it's just, it's cool that The Atlantic is highlighting this, talking about this. And I think in general, one of the big things about micromobility is, like, we can solve for these big inefficiencies in the market, and, you know, it's one ride at a time, but, yeah, I think I'm hopeful that we'll solve these problems, and there'll be more that will come. But, you know, we can knock some out.
Awesome, James. Why don't you take us through the launches?
Yeah, so we got a couple weeks of launches here, Julia. You know, one, I want to talk about a couple car brands. So Honda, last week released the Honda Moto Compacto, which is kind of their 21st century version of their 80s hit, kind of cult classic. The Moto Compacto was designed for like easy storage, you know, people in urban environments. It is like the cutest little thing ever. People loved it. They discontinued it, and now they're bringing it back. And of course, they're bringing it back as an all-electric vehicle, which just seems like so cool and so fun. Honda has been, I think, we've been talking about Honda for a while. They've been a little bit concerned about the release of the vehicle, how would it do, et cetera. So they actually are holding test rides until November because of this. But they'll still hopefully be at Micromobility America. It might be one of those things where it's behind a glass, like kind of the first iPhone was, where we'll just be able to look at it, not actually ride it. But this is a really cool version. And clearly Honda, which has been such innovators in so many mobility spaces, them bringing this back out and really, you know, making a big pledge to micromobility vehicles, I think is a really big deal. Where, again, you see car companies often do concepts that are just for fun. I think this is like a really good concept that can win. So shout out to Honda. And hopefully if you come to Micromobility America, you'll get a first sneak peek, even though you may not be able to ride it, which won't be as fun. As well, Julia, Mini has come out with their own little e-bike. They're calling the Angel Mobility e-bike. There's going to be 1,959 of these made, which is a reference to when Mini was founded in 1959. And it looks like a cool vehicle. We featured it in the newsletter. It's sexy. It's sleek. It's much more like a bike than, say, whatever the Moto Compacto is and how you might want to describe that. But yeah, Mini, Honda in the space. I don't know, Julie, do you have any thoughts here? Is this cool? Is this just PR that they're doing? Do you think they're serious?
I mean, maybe both. I would say on Honda's front, it's a cool looking vehicle. I don't know. I kind of like it. It just like, it seems both fun and functional. And what I find interesting with a lot of these brands, when they're doing their marketing materials, the backdrop is always SoCal. So what that says to me too, is a lot of these companies are actually going after SoCal consumers as their first and biggest market. Super interesting. And then also trying to, you know, use this like SoCal cool to expand their reach to other places. The Mini bike, I don't know. Yes, maybe this is putting their foot in the, you know, water and trying to see whether or not there's a market here for them. What I will say about this bike is it looks like a cowboy bike to me, or it looks like Van Moof to me. It's more of a software-enabled bike. So I don't know what kind of reach this is going to have. Like, I don't know that I would want to purchase a bike like this, but it does seem like they're, you know, testing the wire and figuring out if there's a market for them there. And then if it turns out there's not, they get to say, we did 1959, you know, we're good. It was just a thing that we were adventuring on.
Yeah, good point. All right, moving on. We're running out of time here. So this is not a launch, but it's actually an important announcement for anyone who owns the Trek Avant Plus 7. The CPSC, who will be at Micromobility America, actually, as Julie mentioned, is doing a recall of their product for a brake issue, which is actually a pretty serious issue that, you know, riders, if you do own the Trek Avant 7, you should take this recall very seriously. I wanted to point out two things here, Julia. One is like, this is Trek, which is known for its acoustic bikes. So I think this kind of like is a continued trend where the acoustic bike makers are in the e-bike market, but I don't think they're taking it seriously enough. And two is that the recall, as at least from the guidance of the CPSC, was only 7,000 units, which is a pretty small number in the construct of how many e-bikes are sold. Especially from, you know, some of the ones that we know, like the Rads and the electrics that sell a lot more. So just interesting. One, this is a bummer of a recall. We hope they fix it. We hope it's just a one-time thing. But it's also just an interesting point that, you know, the traditional big brand bike names are not up there on the leaderboard in terms of who's selling e-bikes, which is also just interesting. Moving on to Bose. So our friends at Bose, the scooter, they've now finally declared when they'll actually start delivering these scooters. There's a lot of hype around what Bose has been up to. They've been talking about it for a while. It's good to see that it's headed for production. The first production unit should come out early next year, and the vehicle looks really great. And so we're really excited to see it. both at Micromobility America, and then of course being able to order it here and get deliveries in early 2024. And then my final story, Julia, will go with a celebrity endorsement. So Ryan Reynolds has been raving about his $120,000 ARC electric motorcycle, and which has led to an explosion of interest, not surprisingly, I guess, in a way. It seems like whatever Ryan Reynolds touches sells a lot of, seems like. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. We haven't seen, you know, you got like Bieber on the Super 73. We've seen some celebrity endorsements, or some, and actually I should say Ryan Reynolds is not an endorsement. He loves the vehicle and he's telling people about it. So I don't think he was paid to do it or anything. But yeah, how far away, Julia, do you think are we from, you know, celebrities really endorsing micromobility vehicles like we see them endorse cars and other things?
Yeah. Man, I want to say not far, but I think we are still a little bit farther away. And I think what we're going to have to see is actors and other influencers doing it because they love the product so much rather than they're paid, you know, huge checks to be endorsers. Like there are so many, you know, folks who are endorsing electric cars, which I think is great, or electric trucks, which I think is great, but they're getting paid like a lot of money. LeBron James comes to mind. You know, it's one of the folks who's getting paid a lot of money to endorse some of the electric vehicle options. Again, I don't think we have quite those marketing budgets in the micromobility space. So we're going to have to see actors and influencers who are really, really passionate about the vehicles that they do own, the micromobility vehicles that they do own, in order to have a short-term uptick in adoption in that.
Yep, totally. Yeah, LeBron James with the truck. We got to get LeBron on.
Yeah, I think it was electric Hummer, actually. I'm pretty sure it was electric Hummer.
Yeah, he's a big fan of bikes, though, so we got to get him.
We got to get LeBron on something else, an e-bike, perhaps.
All right, Julia, I'm going to invite Jared Sarti on stage from, not surprising, his company is named after him. Hey, Jared, how are you?
You're doing well. Hi, James. Hi, Julia.
You made it. So, Jared, I want to give a brief introduction on who you are and why you joined us on stage today. So I'm actually going to do it by just kind of took some of the information that I found on your LinkedIn. So you say, Jared says, I've spent my entire life either building things or taking them apart with a background in mechanical engineering at MIT and a career that has spanned from product design at Apple to small startups and consulting. My passion has always been to bring great ideas off the sketchbook into the real world. I'm a passionate mountain biker, father of two young girls, and dual Canadian-American citizen. I see the boundless potential for a company that focuses on building community one bike at a time. So great intro that you did there, and I just took it verbatim. But yeah, tell us more about what you're up to now and your company.
Absolutely, good to meet both of you, and thanks for having me on. I'm Jared. I'm CEO and founder of Sarti Bikes. So as you said in the intro, I used to work at a big company in the Bay Area. I was very used to the 1 to 2 year product life cycle, you know, before the company moved on to the newer, better design. And I've always had a passion for bikes, and I started to see this ethos get adopted by the bike industry, I think, as a way of kind of building customer base. I think that was great, but I know firsthand that bikes are an amazing tool that can last multiple decades if designed properly and taken care of. So I set about building a bike with the core principles of modularity, repairability, and most of all, super fun to ride. It's kind of great what I've been working on.
So, I mean, in terms of, you know, the first thing I think you see when you go to your website and, you know, see your vehicles, which we're really excited to see here in less than a month at Micromobility America, but it's the front-loading cargo. And the first question I have for you, Jared, is why don't we see more front-loaded cargos in the U.S.? I think you see them a lot in Europe and other parts of the world, but you don't see them in the U.S. Just curious why that is and how you plan to solve that.
I'm not an expert in this, but from what I can tell, our cities in North America were not built around a centrally located hub. And so, I mean, it's really hard to get place to place, and cars were the tool to bridge that. And our cities were built around, you know, driving a car over long distances. When you've been to a city that is easy to ride in, what that feels like and how empowering it can be. But, you know, from San Francisco to Vancouver, which are the cities I'm most familiar with, in Boston, it's pretty harrowing sometimes to be on a bike. And I think that's changing and evolving. And it's going to take, you know, a few years, maybe a decade, to really feel like it does now in other countries.
I guess more specifically though, Jared, so I think in the US you see a lot of long tail cargo where of course the cargo is on the back. Your proposition, what you're so excited about launching, is a front loading cargo, which again you see, unless you're just saying it's more of a safety issue and it's slightly safer in the US in Europe than the US. But again, we've seen quite a boom in cargo in the US. We've seen quite a boom on back loaded cargo in the US. We have not seen a boom on front loaded cargo in the US. And just curious what you think that is and how you want to, whether it's change the consumer's mind, or I assume it's not a 20-year plan to have safer infrastructure. Like what do you need to do to convince the consumer to buy a front-loading cargo versus back-loaded cargo?
Yeah. Thanks for the clarification there. Like I think it does tie to building a bike that can do what a car can do so that you can live in this infrastructure that we're stuck with for a while. Since riding front-loading cargo bikes and building them into my daily life, from, you know, kids to weekend adventures, I think that there's something to be said for having that extra capacity and being able to adapt the bike over the years. Like you're very prescribed in our long tail. But I think that the modularity that front loaders offer just hasn't been kind of evolved enough yet in the industry. I don't know exactly why long tails are so much more popular. I think with companies like Rad making them really affordable and ubiquitous, it's done great things. But I think that the more you use it, the more you realize it really can replace car trips. But the thing that I've connected with most is the experience of riding with our girls in the front. There's something completely different from having them behind you and kind of peering around the corner. It's kind of like being in the backseat of the car, but sharing that experience with them up front, being able to like look and observe and see the world together is something that I think is kind of untapped and undiscovered.
Yeah. So, okay. What is like the modularity argument of front loading versus back loading and potentially the ways you can configure? That makes a lot of sense. And you see that a lot. Also the idea of the sort of passenger loading front versus back and the communication exchange, or, you know, just the feeling you get with your passenger cargo being in front of you in back of you is better. I agree with both those points. I'm very intrigued on how you explain that. You know, how do you message that in a way that people start to understand it and advocate for? On the affordability point, what do you think there? Do you ever think front loading will become as affordable as back loading? Is there things that are just, you know, that need to be done and designed in the front loading cargo that will never allow it to compete at a price point with back loading?
I think the main thing there is volume. I honestly don't see it out competing on cost back loading or long tail bike design. That's just not going to happen. And I think that has to do with like just the size of the frame and the volume of manufacturing. But what I do think it can really compete with is the upfront costs and continuing maintenance of owning a car. So I think it's a bit of the wrong comparison to compare it to long tail cargo bikes, because I think that it's not really filling the same gap that they do. I think the correct comparison is against car ownership. Even a small car that's efficient in a city, a front loader bike can really outperform and is a lot more fun than riding in a car. We all know, like, we've seen the comparisons that show that it's, you know, the money talks there, and people can spend less overall.
Yeah. Okay. And then Before I'll kick it over to Julia, because you got a lot of a really good manufacturing story that I think Julia's always interested in covering. But another point here. So how about the, again, if you're, you know, the majority of people in the U.S., you're going to watch in the U.S., let's talk about U.S. here, you know, I've ridden a bike. I'd say the vast majority have not ridden a front-loaded cargo bike, though. And so, you know, one opinion I have is backloading long-tail cargo is just a little bit more like a bike. Once you get onto a front load, it's a slightly different, it's just a slightly different position. It's a slightly different comfort. How do you get over that hump with the customer to understand that, again, some of these benefits are great, like the passengers being in front of you, it's a better experience that way. But what about just the idea that, hey, this is scary, this is hard, yeah, this is heavy, this doesn't balance the same. What's the plan there? How do you change the consumers? Where, you know, how do you get consumers over potentially some of those perception issues?
You know, we've been kind of out and locally public for the past 6 months, and it wasn't till the last month at the Fully Charged show in Vancouver that I really could start to have a good answer for you. And I think the answer is to be with people as they have this new experience and work with them as they learn it. So you're right, the bike is, you know, the very first turn you make on a cargo bike, you're likely going to put a foot down and tip over. And that's a very uncomfortable experience for somebody who's used to riding a bike. But you have that experience with somebody that knows you can do it, it completely changes the game. We didn't have one person fall over or, you know, feel too wigged out to ride the bike when we shared that experience with them. And, you know, it wasn't more than a couple of turns or 30 seconds until they were just as comfortable. And a lot of what I try to do design wise is bridge that gap too. So I think that these bikes they're heavy, you know, they're cumbersome. The steering isn't very comfortable. And those are all things I'm very intimately familiar with as a, you know, kind of adventure rider and enthusiast. And I didn't want to have any reasons why, you know, people can get on and ride away, you know, first try, because it's kind of a make or break moment.
Sure. Yeah. It speaks to a little bit of, as you talk about, really going after the car as a replacement, you know, potentially your sales motion as well, complementing maybe the way cars are sold, which is, you know, you go to the dealership, you try it, you know, you come with a license, of course. So you have a sense of how to drive. Sounds like something similar for you might work very well versus, say, like, let's just, you mentioned Rad earlier, the DTC model of getting the cargo, the backloaded cargo in the mail and putting it together and riding it. With your experience, you might have a more high touch, more of a, you know, a retail sales motion where you're actually touching the customer more, or retail people are touching the customer more, helping with those first couple of rides, which, you know, again, makes a lot of sense if you're going to replace a car for a lot of trips.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's the most efficient way to start a business. I don't think I pick the easier path here. But I love it, and I believe in it so much because of the personal experience that I've had and the connection I've built with other riders that have shared that experience. And you know, I think we're going to do our best to communicate that in a way that meets people where they are. You know, part of going to Micromobility America and the Fully Charged show is to actually make these connections in person. And, you know, it's also a huge bike. It sometimes it comes on a pallet. It's expensive to ship. Like, we can't just send demo bikes across the country. Like, that's not viable for a small company like ours. So we need to connect with people as best as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. Julia, over to you.
Yeah. And Jared might be asking one of the few last questions here. First of all, I always like having people on the show that in their bio say that they're girl dads. So I just wanted to compliment you on that. And amazing to have I guess James is also a girl dad, but a couple of girl dads on the show. The second thing, Jared, is about manufacturing. You manufacture in Canada, or you're manufacturing in Canada. What is that experience like? Why did you decide to do that? And how challenging is it then to import into the U.S. market?
Yeah, thanks. I love my girls. definitely wasn't my fault. But I think, thanks for that. Manufacturing in Canada was something I saw that was important to kind of build on that connection with our customers. I'm familiar with the higher volume Taiwanese manufacturing and the minimum orders that are needed for that, but I wanted the opportunity to build bikes exactly as our customers wanted them. And if there wasn't something about the original build that worked for them, I wanted, you know, really no reason why we couldn't adapt and change and focus on their needs directly. This is a big purchase, and I think it's difficult when you're in that situation trying to sell something that isn't quite a great fit for the customer. It was also easier to kind of bootstrap a company off of a lower volume manufacturing process. So we have pre-ordered a lot of the components that we think are standardized, but we focus completely on building the frames, you know, one at a time or batch at a time. And building up bikes as the orders come in.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I know we're getting close to time here, but Jared, really wanted to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us about your product and also about being at Micromobility America. I think James is this one of the only or the only Frontail cargo bike that we're going to have at the show?
I think there'll be others, but you know, I think it's the most. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the most intriguing. I think the story of how you're manufacturing it, Jared, is amazing, and I hope you're getting help from the Canadian government on that. And so I think it's a great story, and definitely the as well. I don't want to say it's the only Frontail large team because I might be wrong on that even, but yeah, it's a very cool story, and we're excited to have you, Jared, and you know, very excited to ride it. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to meeting you both in person and showing people what we've been working on. It's going to be great to be back in the Bay Area again.
Yeah, we'll sure. Have you back. Okay, Jared.
All right, yeah, Jared, so thank you again.
All right, thank you too. Have a good one. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Right.
All right, Julia, that's it for the show. We're running late, and we'll see you next week. Right on.
Right on.